And this is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and myself, Mimi Rosenberg. 50 years later, has the U.S. learned anything from the Newark rebellions? On July 12, 1967, the African-American residents of Newark rebelled, sparked by the beating of a black cab driver by white police officers, and would leave 26 people killed, more than 700 injured, and millions of dollars of property damage, vandalized and burned properties. Joining us are two of my most honored historians, educators, agitators, activist, Junius Williams, who served as the chair of the committee celebrating the 350th anniversary of the founding of the city of Newark, the people's lawyer, educator, activist, and Larry Hamm, who's been organizing and agitating and protesting for more than a quarter of a century, chairperson of what Ken and I think is one of the most important organizations in the entire country.
The People's Organization for Progress, and we want a chapter in New York City.
Oh, we're still going there, right, Larry? New York
That's
City.
Right.
Well, thank you both for being with us at a very sober time in our history, in the history of Newark. And I want to begin with Junius Williams, your understanding, your involvement, your concerns. What do you write today of your role in the 1967 African-American rebellions in Newark?
Thank you and Ken for having me on. I appreciate this opportunity. I often listen to your show. As I wrote in my book, Unfinished Agenda, Urban Politics in the Era of Black Power, the Newark Rebellion was a central point in my young life at that time and in Newark's life. It was the first time I looked down the wrong end of an automatic shotgun and fortunately walked away. The other part on Newark was a little more difficult. This was a series of events that led to the most important set of 5 days in the 20th century in Newark history. People were feeling the pain before the rebellion. Rapacious landlords, store owners that cheated and gouged the public, welfare officials who didn't write checks when they should have, schools with white teachers who didn't particularly want to teach black kids, and when they did, they held them to a lower standard, and of course the police power. That's what tipped it off. People need to understand, however, that there was a long history of black people and white people working together, trying to use a nonviolent approach, which had worked in the South, using demonstrations, picket lines, takeovers, trying to do what was necessary to give people some opportunity for redress of grievance because the power structure just was not listening.
I just want you to tell us a little bit more about the 12-gauge shotgun. Just to give a real sense of the environment. And I guess it was 12-gauge, right?
No, it was automatic.
Automatic. Worse.
Not that it would have mattered. Well, I and two other guys, we were riding up Court Street in Newark in my car. We were out after curfew on the second day, just looking to see what was going on. I heard the cop first, and I saw the light. Said to myself, we are in some deep stuff. They pulled me over. We got out. They said, up against the car, mother, you know what? We did that, and we stayed there while they searched the car. And what they found in my trunk were law books. The man with the shotgun, I call him Shotgun Man, and then there was Pistol Man. Pistol Man was pointing at us, hoping that we would run, but everybody was cool. But then the sergeant looked at their law books and told his men, their law students, let them go. And he had to say that three times. Now, he was supposed to be in charge, but they wanted to kill us. He finally talked them into getting back in the car. They put away their weapons, zoomed on up. I just thanked that sergeant.
Larry, Junius talked a bit about the causes of the rebellion. Do you want to flesh that out a bit? What was happening in Newark before the rebellion? What kicked it off?
Let me say, first of all, what a major contribution Junius Williams' book is, Unfinished Agenda. I have urged members of the People's Organization for Progress to read this book, and he really flushes out in detail, and he makes the events of those days, that period, very real. At the time of the rebellion, in July 67, I had just graduated from the eighth grade. I was at my friend's house. Some other friends came upstairs and said, Springfield Avenue is on fire. And we went to run downstairs, to run down to Springfield Avenue. But when I got downstairs, Junius, my mother was across the street on the porch. She's like, bring your behind back across the street. You're not going down there. By doing that, she probably saved my life. Conditions were very harsh. And it's not like today we have a picnic. I mean, conditions are still harsh. It's difficult for people to conceive. Most of the housing in Newark was substandard housing, cold water flat. And we lived for a time in a cold water flat. There was no running hot water. You had to get a big tub, put the tub on the stove, heat the tub up just to take a bath or to do anything else that you needed hot water for. In the black community, you know, most people's homes were heated by coal. And this coal heat was very unhealthy and contributed to the asthma. Many children have and still have asthma in urban areas because of the pollution. But the coal and the police were vicious at that time. We lived in an apartheid city. Newark was a predominantly black city with a white power structure. 90% of the police were white in Newark. So we looked at the police as an occupation force, almost like an army of foreigners that had come in to conquer and suppress us. So conditions were very bad. Housing was overcrowded. The city was segregated. Most black people lived in the Central Ward and close environs to the Central Ward because of redlining. You know, when I was a kid, to go to the South Ward, to go across Central Avenue, that was like going to another city. And it was just a matter of time before something happened. But I'm going to give you perspective. I didn't know that the riot was coming. I think it took a lot of people in our neighborhood by surprise.
Let me hold you on that for a second. Yep. So, Junius, we left off with Larry saying he didn't know he was coming, but he was a youngster at that time. Mm-hmm. Your experience, what did you understand about what almost had to happen and why, I don't know if you agree with me, but why I call it rebellions rather than riots, because rebellions are a different level of response to oppression. Your own thoughts.
Let me first thank Larry for that endorsement of my book. Yes, he did arrange for a book party at the People's Organization for Progress. And I want everybody to know that the first group we call upon if there is a crisis is POP. And I am a card-carrying member. So with respect to that proposition you put, we thought there was going to be a rebellion. And at the time, we all called it a riot. We had seen what had happened in Harlem. We'd seen what had happened in Watts. Harlem was 64. Watts was 65. Those of us who were organizing and were speculating as to whether it was going to happen. Mayor Adonijo was the one who didn't think it was going to happen. Mayor Adonijo was going to run for governor. He did not want that to happen because he wanted to be the first Italian governor of New Jersey. He was surprised, but we were not. Why was it a rebellion? Because, as you said, Mimi, when people can't take it anymore, they stand up. If somebody's got their foot up your behind all the time, and when you try to stand up, that's a rebellion when you try to stand up, because you are not going to just take this all the time. Now, if the courts had worked, fined the landlords and said you can't do this, if the courts had said that about the store owners, if the welfare bureaucracy had been kinder, if the school, I think they had maybe one or two black principals and most of the teachers were white, if there had been some accountability for what was not happening for the people of Newark on all of those fronts, then people would have said, well, we're going to try it the nonviolent way. We're going to listen to Junius Williams and Tom Hayden, to all of these people in CORE and the UCC who are saying, well, let's have nonviolent protests and see if we can't change some people's minds. If that had happened, then there would not have been a rebellion. But when those police beat up cab driver, beat him senseless because he just passed them, because they were double parked on the street trying to get around them. And the people in the community, which was Hayes Homes, a high-rise public housing, hundreds of people out on the street on a hot night in July, when the people did that, saw that, they thought he was dead. So they decided to settle it Old Testament stuff.
Junius, the calling in of the National Guard, what happened after that?
That's an interesting story, too, because the mayor, according to the deputy mayor, Paul Riley, who I interviewed for our website, RiseUpNorth.com, according to deputy mayor Paul Riley, he didn't want the governor to come in and take over. But when you ask for help, that's what you get. So the governor called in, he mobilized the National Guard, he sent in the state police, and that, in essence, put the police, the local police, under the command of the state folks. They came in with one thing in mind, and that was to stop the violence. They didn't care about collateral damage, anything black that moved, they shot or beat or put in jail or some combination thereof. And that's how 26 people got killed, because there was no evidence of any snipers. The riot commission report that the governor set up, there was no evidence. I think there were 250, 230 reports of snipers. Nobody found any evidence. No spent shells, no fingerprints, nothing. They were shooting at each other, or they were shooting up at these projects and at the people's houses, and that's how people got killed.
And let me just tell our listeners again that we're speaking with Junius Williams, who is an educator, a writer, an activist, a lawyer, and who was there and has written about four, really, the 50 years since the riots of, or rebellions, as the case may be, of July 12th, 1967. And Larry Hamm, chairperson of the People's Organization for Progress. Larry, and there's always that feeling, that sensitivity, that conditions are such that it may not be the same cold water flat, but I know how many people in New York are homeless. I know generally what class, and I know what racial group they belong to.
Right.
And so I'm still poised and would not be surprised given the police violence, etc. Is that true for you, Larry Hamm? Is that true for you, Junius Williams? Larry?
Yes. Until the conditions that gave rise to the rebellion are eliminated, there will be more rebellion. Black people have a long and complex history here in the Western Hemisphere and here in the United States. But one dimension of that historical experience that is not given adequate examination is the dimension of resistance and rebellion. Our history is a history of rebellion. That's why our theme year after year, because the People's Organization for Progress, we have held an observance of the 1967 rebellion and uprising every year of this will be the 34th year of the existence of our organization, and every year we have observed the 1967 Newark Rebellion, because it was such a seminal event in the history of Newark, but not just Newark, in the history of black people in this country. The rebellion came into being because people were tired of being oppressed. And Junius talked about some of the conditions that existed. I mentioned some of the conditions, but many of those conditions continue to exist. One might make an argument, I mean, I haven't seen any hard figures on this, but there might actually be more portion of the population of Newark living in poverty today might actually be greater than it was in 1967. We know that there are twice as many poor people in America today as there were in 1967 and in 1968 when Dr. King was killed. Unemployment in black urban communities almost consistently somewhere between 40 to 60%, especially when you break out the demographic of black men from the ages of, say, 18 to 35, astronomical rates of unemployment and poverty, and not to mention the racism, particularly the racism and brutality of the police. This is the witch's brew that, in fact, gives rise to uprisings. Black people have had urban uprisings in America in the beginning of the 20th century, after World War II, during the 60s, from 1960 to 1971, there were over 1,000 urban uprisings. There hasn't been a decade since 1967 when there hasn't been an eruption in one city or another. Most recently, we have Baltimore, and then before Baltimore, it was Ferguson. And there'll be another city, probably this summer. And until the conditions are eliminated that give rise to this type of resistance, we'll continue to see these kinds of rebellion. But the 60s were a different period. I mean, in 67 and 68, between those 2 years alone, there were almost 400 rebellions in the United States.
I agree with what he said, and it could happen at any moment. I have a little different take on the quality of oppression at this point. And there was one very important missing ingredient. I think people's expectations have been dumbed down. People have accepted oppression as the new normal, whereas that didn't happen in the 60s because there were these unpredictable neighborhood groups of which I was a part and other people were a part, raising people's expectations, telling them, you have a right to the tree of life. We don't have that universally anymore. And so, yes, you do get a Baltimore, but it's not like a Newark or a Detroit. I don't think people expect very much anymore. And as a matter of fact, the symptom is that they are engaged in violence and the uprising is against one another. You got young people who are wearing red versus young people who are wearing blue. And what are they fighting for? They're fighting for a street corner. We were fighting for the liberation of an entire people. They have been accustomed now to just fighting for a street corner. I don't say that to put them down. That's just the objective reality. The young men and young women who are now in the Bloods and the Crips, back in 50 years ago, they would have been in SNCC. They would have been in CORE. They would have been in the Black Panthers. That was the basis of our nonviolent army, which was putting so much pressure on America that it had to do something. But it made the powers that be do something. Now all the powers that we have to do is say, well, they out of line, send in the police, and that's it.
Well, we do have the People's Organization for Progress, which is exactly that kind of organization. And I have to say, Junius Williams, I heard you say that same thing about 10 years ago, and I was just actually coming back from a trip to Rikers Island, and I thought and I looked at these wonderful young men and young women that were there and thought to myself, you were exactly right. The 60s and the 70s, they would have had a place to use their enormous creativity and their lust for liberation and empowerment in a holistic and comprehensive organization that spoke truth to power and was fighting for self-determination for a people. And that's some of what's missing today, as I think the ingredient and the whole struggle for empowerment rather than a reactive struggle to respond to the latest police abuse of power. I don't know, Larry?
No, I agree with that. I think Larry Ham and People's Organization can't do it all.
I thought they could, actually.
They're doing a lot.
In the 60s, there was a proliferation of these groups. Sometimes we got along with each other. Sometimes we didn't. But they were there with a network of folks. And young people just can't appreciate. One day you were at a demonstration with the welfare rights group. The next day you with the NAFA, which was my organization fighting against the urban renewal. Another day you with CORE fight. We used to have a party on Thursday, every Thursday in the NAFA organization. And we would plan out our week about what we were going to do. And you just don't have that level of engagement so that people would then go for
Larry Ham.
I agree with Junius in the general sense that, yes, we are faced with a more challenging set of conditions. We have to examine why that is. Part of the reason is certainly the counterinsurgency measures that were taken against the Black Liberation Movement of the 60s. When we rebelled, we were met with the force of the state, with open violence and with other surreptitious means. the infiltration of black organizations, the assassination of black leaders. Probably the most well-known of these efforts was COINTELPRO. There was COINTELPRO, and then there were COINTELPRO-like operations that were carried out by local police departments. Local police departments were known to have a black desk or a red desk for radicals and communists and so on. And so there was a concerted effort, both using soft counterinsurgency measures as well as hard, violent counterinsurgency measures to meet what they thought was a revolutionary situation in America. I mean, if you had almost 150 uprisings in your cities across the country every year, you would be very concerned if you were in power. And so the FBI and the intelligence agencies of various kinds of the military, they went to work to, in fact, undermine and destroy black organizations. But in part, that is why there is this disconnect. That's one of the reasons why we don't have the plethora of black liberation-type organizations that we did, because Junius is right, that we did have a success. I mean, I can just name, in Newark alone, there was a Committee for a Unified Newark, there was a Black Panther Party, there was CORE, led by Bob Kerman, there was the NAACP, there was the Black People's Topographical Research Center. I could go on and on and on naming these groups, and most of these groups don't exist today, and they don't exist because the state in one way or another moved against them. And I think this is the real issue right now. The question is how do we link the struggles for both reform in the struggle to change and improve our condition? How do we link the struggle for revolutionary transformation to the struggles for immediate reform? Because this was another stumbling block of the black liberation movement during the 60s. You know, we thought, and naively so, not all of us, but many of us thought, if we just elect black faces to high places, as Brother Amiri Baraka used to say, you know, everything will be all right because the brothers and sisters will get in there and they'll take care of us. Well, that didn't happen. And in some instances, these, for lack of another term, another one, these neo-colonial type situations where you had a kind of black municipal power structure that was in fact under the domination of the larger white power structure, we found ourselves at odds many times with the very people that we had helped to bring to power. Junius Williams got me out of jail. I got locked up by the black city council president in 1974 because he didn't like what I said about what the city council was doing regarding a housing project that Amiri Baraka was attached to in the Central Ward. He had me arrested on the spot, dragged out, and taken to the jail. And I had to call my wife to call Junius Williams to sit there to come get me out of jail the next morning. But this is a real issue that we had to confront, this question. You know, Nkrumah wrote the book Neocolonialism, The Last Stage of Imperialism. I mean, we're not an independent country. We're not a colony. But there is a colonial-type kind of relationship that exists. And after black power, we've had 40 years of black power now. You know, mm-hmm. And what that has to be assessed. What was its revolutionary value? What was its counter-revolutionary value? I mean, these things have to be assessed and summed up. And Junius does that to a degree in his book.
Junius, so I can't help but say we have Mayor Raz Baraka and Amiri Baraka, really the poet laureate of revolution, of self-determination, who was intimately involved at that time in the lifeblood, literally, of Newark, was himself brutally beaten. We now have his son, who is the mayor. Just in the final time, what do you think that means? Is there some kind of vindication that Raz is now the mayor of Newark, his lineage being from Amiri Baraka, after all that you all went through and continue to go through as people who are progressives, as people who are humanists, as people who are fighting for our empowerment in very clearly worsening times? Junius,
well, let's,
Williams?
Let's just follow the logic that Brother Larry just very
laid out very well. Because we did have people who were in power and didn't understand the nature of the reality, and because they were good people but didn't have any kind of ideological concept of what to do, I say in my book, the power in the street must accompany the power in the suite, the suite being City Hall. What happened was that all the people that Larry talked about and that I talked about, we were either driven away from City Hall or people left down or people died. Mm-hmm. And as a result, that knowledge base went away from us. So the next generation and now another generation and now another generation knows nothing about the kind of organization that we're talking about. Larry is almost as old as I am, and he's still one of the few who understands community organization, not just mobilization, but organization. That whole thing has left us. So now we have Raz Baraka, who understands all of this, but his resources have been cut severely. But I think he is doing as much as could possibly be done. I don't think we're going to have a rebellion on his watch. For example, he has said we're going to have a police review board, and he has set up a police review board. That hasn't happened in very many cities with the approval of the mayor. He says we're going to have a new set of policy with respect to hiring people. He has called upon the people who have the jobs and the economic wherewithal, and he said, within a certain amount of time, I don't remember exactly.
Well, you know, I'm gonna have to cut you there. But we've just got to have more of these conversations and longer because they're too important not to. People must read. It's such a critical book. Unfinished Agenda, Urban Politics in the Era of Black Power by the extraordinary Junius Williams. Go to his website, Rise Up North. It is excellent. There's so much on it. And, of course, Larry Hamm, who's going to be commemorating the 50th anniversary of the 1967 Newark Rebellion, from slave resistance to urban uprising in Newark, New Jersey.
And Mimi, let me slip this in. To kick off 5 days of commemoration, we have the mayor. We're going to go through the history of the rebellion, young people talking, gospel choir singing, Sister Stephanie and her jubilation choir.
Thank you. Two of the finest brothers that I've ever met and had the pleasure of organizing with. Larry Hamm, Junius Williams, it's an honor.
Let's
thank
do it
you
again.
For having us on.
Oh, yes, you know it. We will do it again. Thank you.
Let's pick up where we left off.
All right.
Always. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.